Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Hello, hello, and welcome aboard another episode of Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, of course, a brand new magazine out now. So if you haven't got a copy, make sure you grab yourself a copy at your local newsagent or in your supermarket store. And welcome aboard. Nice to have you with us for another week. Coming up on today's program, we're going to go behind the scenes, yes, not too far away, and have a very good chat with a good friend of ours by the name of Angus Stewart. And of course, Angus has got some great information on winter gardens today. Christy Paisley will be joining us. She's going to be talking us about the golden age of prints. And Michelle McHugh will take us behind the scenes and talk about tomatoes. And Therese Mudgeway, she's always got something interesting to say. We're going to learn about observing our inner observer today on the program, right here on Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Okay, Michael, well, we've got a guy on the line called Michael Moore, who is busy running his restaurant summit, cooking on television, climbing the ranks of top chefs in the world, and travelling the globe. And he's with us today on the program.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
Great to speak to you.
Yeah. Now, you had it well, and still do, have an extraordinary life. You were already a diabetic. I think you realised you had that around 35.
And that's right.
You were a top chef, I guess, surrounded by, you know, amazing food and that daily challenge of eating healthy. But one day, it all changed, didn't it, when you had a major stroke in front of your family when you were out to dinner. And your life changed. Your whole philosophy around food changed, and you have created the most extraordinary cookbook, Blood Sugar Inspiring Recipes, for anyone facing the challenge of diabetes and maintaining good health.
When a stroke hits you, you're never prepared for it. You know, in your 40s, you're not thinking that, you know, a stroke is even on the horizon. You know, you can, there are certain illnesses and things that can you expect to happen, but a stroke certainly isn't one of them. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't survive a stroke in the way that I have. I have zero deficit, and you know, I'm back to work and everything seems to be working and in good order, so I'm a very lucky boy.
The night it happened, you know, in front of your family, your kids and your wife, what was their reaction? Like, just talk us through what immediately happened.
Well, I was actually cooking at the barbecue in the pub, and I was grilling steaks, and my kids were talking to the other people saying, my dad's a celebrity chef, and you know, the other people saying, well, you can keep an eye on my steak, then I'll have my medium rare sort of thing. So it was all sort of a light-hearted Sunday afternoon sort of dinner. And you know, I basically collapsed. And when they say that, you know, a stroke or a heart attack, you'll get a tingling in your arm and a feeling of numbness, well for me it hit me like an elephant gun. I just crash. I hit the floor, and my children were hysterical. My wife saw me on the floor and thought that I'd had a diabetic hypo, that I'd had a low sugar. And she said to the barman, grab some lemonade and orange juice and whatever. And then she realized that my whole left side was paralyzed and I couldn't talk. And you know, it was a pretty sort of scary situation for the family. And yeah,
having seen your kids watch you go through that, I know you have found that very hard, haven't you?
Yeah, it was one of the hardest moments of the whole sort of experience, was hearing my 11-year-old daughter say to my mother that when they put Dad in the ambulance, I thought it was the last time that I was ever going to see him. And you know, that as a parent, that is just like a brick to the head. You know, it's just an absolute shock.
So those relationships, those very close relationships with your wife and your children, how have they changed?
My relationships with everyone in my life have changed, in that as a person, I've been highly motivated and incredibly focused on the future and highly driven. And now, whilst I'm still driving forward, I'm enjoying where I am every day, and I enjoy being in the present. And just, you know, I'm happy to be at that barbecue or that lunch or something like that, and I'm not worried too much about what I'm doing that night or the next day. Whilst there's a plan there, I try to enjoy the moment. I listen to people a lot more than I did, and I'm sort of far more present than I was.
The cookbook Blood Sugar that you're about to launch, I get the impression is probably a cookbook you may not have ever published or dreamed of publishing 10 years ago.
No, absolutely. It was a stroke. My communications guy sort of works on sort of books and media with me. He came into the hospital whilst I was laying there in the bed, and he said, well, you know, well, I better look for a new job. Am I going to be retrenched sort of thing? And I said, don't worry. I've come up with an idea. I'm going to write a book called Blood Sugar, and I'm going to become the poster boy for diabetic health and stroke recovery. And we sort of used blood sugar as part of my rehab.
Good on you. Michael Moore, congratulations. Fabulous book. And I know this radio interview and the story we're going to do with you in the pages of the magazine will definitely help people out there.
That's fantastic. It's been great talking to you guys.
Thanks.
Fantastic. Talking with Michael Moore, author of a brand new book called Blood Sugar. And, of course, for more details, go to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio with Ben and Michael. Michelle is standing by. She's got tomatoes. Our food director's been very busy this week. Why tomatoes?
Well, I think tomatoes is sort of, you know, autumn is the last picking of the tomatoes if you grow them at home, and they are, you know, in the shops at the moment, and they're really cheap, so it's a nice time to be really using tomatoes, and they're so delicious. It's man, I just love a tomato on toast, or, you know, any sort of tomato.
Actually, you
I
did,
love them.
You did, right. I was in the supermarket the other day, and I can't believe how many tomatoes there are, like all the different versions, but they're very cheap at the moment too.
They are. But so we've got some lovely tomato recipes, and I'm going to kick it off today by telling you about a pickle, which means you can make these tomatoes that you're buying cheap last you, you know, a little bit longer by storing them in the fridge and in preserving jars. And this is a beautiful recipe that we've got. You can store this for up to 3 months. So what we do is we basically get the tomatoes and we make a small slit in them, and we put a little bit of salt in there, and that draws out the moisture of the tomato. And then we leave those for about half an hour sitting in the colander. And then we, in a small fry pan, we're going to toast off some nigella seeds, some coriander, some cumin, some celery seeds with a little bit of chilli. And then we're going to mix that up with roasted garlic. And then we'll rinse out the tomatoes, dry them off, and then we put that those crushed seeds into the tomatoes, into the cavity we've made in the tomatoes, and then pop them into the sterile jars and then cover them with vinegar. And how good does that sound?
That sounds really
beautiful.
Good. And you can have that forever, couldn't you? That'd last. Well, in our house, it probably wouldn't hang around.
But yeah, no, put them into the fridge for a few days and then let that settle. And then, you know, it can last up to about 3 months.
Now, I've noticed in the latest issue, we've sort of gone very international. We've got a beautiful caponata recipe there from Italy and a great one from Egypt, a kashari. Tell us a little bit about those.
Oh, gosh. Well, the kashari is, I'm not too sure about the pronunciation, but that will do for us today. that is an Egyptian street food, and it's vegetarian, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's made from, we're making with a brown lentil, and you just basically fry up a whole lot of onions, and it's got an amazing combination. You've got pasta and rice and lentils, and oh, it's just beautiful. And I have to say, I think I'm going to make that again tonight. It looks like a good, you know, good thing to have in the fridge over the weekend.
And easy for kids, like kids would like that.
Kids would love it. What kids don't like rice and pasta? No, it's beautiful. Nice and spicy.
And listen, what about a soup recipe? Have you got a good soup recipe?
Well, we've also got a tomato and fennel soup, so that's another beautiful combination. And that's a nice, easy recipe. As again, it's taking it right back to the fennel seeds and thyme, and we've got some white wine. It's a beautiful, and you can use... tinned if you can't get fresh, but at this time of year we can all get fresh. And no, it's a beautiful recipe, and it's served with a nice with fennel seeds and parsley and sour cream. I think if you're having friends over on the cooler nights, it's going to be an absolute treat.
Indeed, indeed. Now, of course, for more details, if we'd like to find out all about these wonderful recipes, we've got to get the magazine. And can we go online as well, Michelle?
We can for the tomato pickle, but the other recipes, I'm afraid, you're going to have to buy the issue.
Fantastic. And, of course, there's lots of other wonderful recipes in there to choose from as well.
Oh, there are so many recipes. And of course, with Easter coming up, we've got a beautiful recipe in there for an Easter cinnamon pull-apart bun. And it looks absolutely beautiful. And that's iced with chocolate icing and some candied walnuts.
Well, Michelle, thanks for tantalising the taste buds today.
There goes the diet and the new resolution, New Year's resolution.
Yeah, Michael just came back in with his Easter bunny rabbit ears on for that Easter special. So there you go.
And listen, don't forget, if you want some of our recipes, you can get them every day sent into your email. We do a daily recipe, and there's also a weekly menu plan that we can send out to you on a Monday.
Fantastic. Well, until next time, take care.
Thank you.
There you have it. Michelle, our food director, joining us today. For more details, jump onto mindfood.com. Michael, you're looking very zen-like at the moment. You're in a bit of a calm state.
I sure am. Well, do you know what? We launched Mind Food Relaxation CDs probably 5-6 months ago. And
yeah.
There are so many people zined out there now because...
But there's a lot of stress, isn't there?
Oh, there is. And the thing is, they are absolutely extraordinary. We worked with a very close friend of mine, Rhonda Stewart, who heads up the Australian College of Hypnotherapy. Are you there, Rhonda?
I'm here.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, look, it's great to have you on board. And listen, you know, the CDs have gone like gangbusters, but tell us a little bit about the college and what you do.
I run the Australian College of Clinical Hypnotherapy, and I teach and train people into being professionals in the industry of hypnosis and in neurolinguistic programming. Mm.
Now, you have a whole range of clients, though, don't you? So what are people coming to you mainly for?
I see a lot of people with stress, and that can lead to anxiety and phobia.
Right.
And I do a lot of work with families and children.
Now, you've had some extraordinary turnarounds with children, haven't you?
Amazing turnarounds with children, absolutely.
Are they a little bit more open, do you think, in terms of this technique?
Yeah, I do. I think they're much more in the design of practically applying. And a lot of what we do is designed around self-help tools as well that you give your client to take away.
Hmm.
And children seem to adapt more to them.
So do people have to hit rock bottom before, you know, do they have to be severely stressed out to come to you and then, I mean, because it's a big deal. You're stressed, your anxiety is heightened, and then on top of it you've got phobias. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't be really proud about talking about that stuff, so they hide it for a long time before they probably get to you.
No, it's true. I mean, we get people at different points, but you're quite right. It's normally when it's really having an effect on them that they decide, I need to do something about this. And hypnotherapy is the fastest acting model of therapy for things like anxiety and stress. It's renowned throughout the world for being the most effective treatment for stress.
So what type of phobias would people come with?
I get a large number of people that have problems driving over a bridge, of all things.
Oh, wow.
We get people that have difficulty getting into lifts. I get clients that have difficulty being in a room with more than a couple of people. They have phobias about presenting or about being put on the spot for communication in their workplace.
Have you seen a growing trend? I know you've been doing this for many years. Have you seen a growing trend of a, you know, a certain phobia?
Yes, definitely. And I'd say that's anxiety, work-related anxiety.
Mm.
Definitely a growing trend.
So from your perspective, what should people be doing to take control of their lives?
Looking at outlets that actually stimulate de-stressing, and that can be things like swimming, meditation, yoga, listening to our CDs.
yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That should be at the top of that list,
that
Rhonda.
That should be at the top, I agree.
So the CDs were created, so the power of music is very powerful in the process of healing, isn't it?
Oh, look, it really is. I believe that music is definitely the healer of our souls. And our CDs are designed to be put on without listened to, so that they're actually working on resetting our sleep cycles and really communicating with that unconscious person and stimulating some response into new resourcefulness.
So they're not music CDs, they're more spoken word, are they?
They're both. There's music in the background, but it's actually spoken, yeah. Mm. And it's not in a language that you'd consciously sit and listen to and make sense of. It's really designed for your unconscious mind to get a sense of what's not working for you and what it could actually do a better job at.
I know those people that have bought the Mind Food CDs, it's really helped them, so thanks for that.
And thank
listen,
you.
You can go online and watch Rhonda. We've got an interview online at mindfood.com. Thanks a lot, Rhonda Stewart, from the Australian College of Hypnotherapy.
Thank you for having me.
Thank
Bye
you.
For
I'm
now.
Feeling very relaxed, Michael.
I'm ready for Nine-Nos.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And it's Mind Food Radio, wherever you are right around Australia. You can listen in on our mindfood.com website, of course, and have a look at some of the podcasts there that we've done in the past. We've got Angus Stewart joining us now. How are you, Angus?
I'm very well, thanks, Ben.
And we're talking about winter gardens today, getting ready for winter.
Yes, look, we're getting to that cusp in the seasons where the sort of warmer months are starting to wind down as summer sort of comes to an end. And a lot of those wonderful food plants that we grow, the annuals, corn and tomatoes, all those things are starting to reach the end of their life, the zucchinis and so on. So it's time to start thinking about that transition to to the colder months of the year and how you can make that happen efficiently in the garden.
As someone who gardens a lot like yourself, which season do you prefer?
I tend to prefer winter in terms of comfort. You can get warm, but summer's wonderful because it's such a good growing season. If you've got enough water, then the temperature, just things grow out of their skin. So very rewarding growing all your edible plants then because they just take off and it's hard to stop them if you've got enough water, as I say.
So if we're getting ready for winter, what are some of the things we need to be looking out for now as we start to plan for this?
It's about, I think, when those vegetables are coming to an end, the summer ones, don't worry about sort of prolonging their life right to the bitter end because it's really the soil preparation is the key to having a great sort of food garden through the winter. So, I'd like to be a little bit ruthless and look at, you've come to the end and it's time now to dig over and start preparing for the next crop, because that soil preparation is really the thing that's going to set you up for the next.
So is resting the soil very important?
Nurturing the soil, I suppose. So fallowing the soil is, giving it a rest. That can be a one approach to that. But I think you can also, there's other things you can do. What I love to do is what we call a green manure crop, where you put in a crop of something just as a very short-term thing, some sort of legume like peas or beans, that you just let them grow up until they're just about to flower, and it seems counterintuitive, but you then dig all that plant matter into the soil, and literally it becomes a green manure that rots down, and as it's rotting down, all the microbes decompose that vegetation greatly sort of stimulate the health of the soil. The earthworms breed up and they'll do a lot of the cultivation for you. So you can sneak in a green manure crop sort of through the autumn and then dig that in and then you're ready for things like your broccoli and peas and so on in winter.
Sounds fabulous. Now, what sort of plants should we be looking at to start to look at purchasing?
I love to grow things from seed. So it's probably a bit of a lost art for a lot of gardeners, but the if you actually plant your seed straight into the garden, you'll get a much better plant usually. You can buy seedlings and boom, they're sort of ready-made, but the root system often is a bit compromised, where if you prepare your soil and then sow the seeds straight in and then you can sort of thin the plants out to a more manageable level. That will give you a much better crop in my experience. So I'm thinking, the cool climate, broccoli and peas, cabbages, all those sort of, it depends a bit on the climate you're in too.
Yeah.
It's a good idea to just get on the internet and have a look at what suits your particular climate. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Angus, thanks for joining us today and have a great day, hey?
My pleasure.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Michael, we're always interested in some of the stories that you get, and you've been chatting with Tabitha Coffey. You've been doing a big article on this.
We have, and we've followed Tabitha's career. She, most of you would know her from Tabitha's Salon Takeover.
Cool,
which is,
cool.
It is a cool show where she goes into these salons and she makes them over. The salon owners often don't love it, but by the end of the show, they love her, and they've kind of had this extraordinary transformation. So the thing is with Tabitha, she's here and she's travelling around New Zealand and Australia, and we're a great fan of hers, I've got to say, in Mind Food. It's very watchable. And welcome to the show, Tabitha. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Tabitha, I've got to tell you, everyone at the Mind Food office is so excited that we're talking to you today.
I love that. And I just got off a plane from LA.
Tabitha, we're great fans of Tabitha's Salon Takeover, but you're actually here in New Zealand and Australia with Joico, who you've worked for many years.
I have. I worked for Joico for maybe 12 years, and I'm back in Australia and New Zealand actually doing business classes for hairdressers, so I'm very excited.
And will it be like Salon Takeover, where you actually go into these salons and sort of, you know, see what's wrong and kind of point it out?
No, I'm not going into people's salons, although that would be fabulous. I'm actually just holding business classes for hairdressers. So, look, it's hard at the moment. The recession is really hard. It's all over the world. It's struggling for small business owners out there.
Mm.
So it's really just coming back home and being able to give, you know, tips and tricks and marketing advice and ways for people to actually stand out in the crowd so that they can keep their doors open and make some money and, you know, be the hairdressers that they want to be.
Tabitha, do most people, are they open to your advice when it comes to when you have to be really, well, so I suppose cutting and true to them?
Look, it's hard. You know, when I go in with the show, I go into these salons and they really only have a week, and I have a true week to take them over and turn them around. And I'm kind of like a mirror. So I point out all the things that they're doing wrong and all the things that they need to change. And it's really hard for people to internalize all of that and make the change. And that's where the resistance comes from. So some of them are really open to it. Some of them, you know, not so much. But as you guys watch the show, you see the people that really do make the change and it's really genuine, and you see the people that really don't make the change, and sometimes those people aren't around for much longer.
But those transformations, you know, the people that are really anti you in terms of what you stand for coming in, you know, how dare you kind of change my world, change my business, they're often the ones at the end that are just so, you know, full of praise and thank goodness, if it wasn't for you, you know, my life would have been so empty. What is that like in terms of giving those people that complete new lease on life?
Look, it's amazing. You know, I take it really seriously. I know it's a TV show, but, you know, for me it's really serious, and it's actually dealing with people's lives and dealing with people's livelihood, and the stakes are really high for a lot of these people that I go into. So for me it's really serious, and when people do make a change and when they can keep their doors open and when they can make money and get their life and business back on track, you know, it's the best reward that I can get, because during the three seasons of the show, I'm in contact with probably 85% of the businesses that I've taken over. And I know, you know, how they're doing and the improvements that they've made and the fact that, you know, they're doing really well and they've paid down their debt and all of those kind of things. And it really is so incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, it's so good to hear that, because I think as a viewer, you think of those reality TV shows as so such a slice of time, that it's great to hear that there is that sort of follow-up and genuine interest from you.
You know, I'm a hairdresser, so that's what I've done for 30 years, and it's what I love, and I really do care about these salons. I mean, that's part of where my aggravation comes from and my angst, and, you know, where you see me get really kind of PO'd, that all comes from me trying to help these people. So I don't want the cameras to go down and then me walk away and not be there for them. So they have my cell phone number, they have my email, and I'm in contact with them to make sure that they're okay. And if they need anything, I'm always there to be a cheerleader for them.
Tabitha, thanks so much. And enjoy your stay. You know, you returned to home in Australia and travelling around New Zealand. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Fantastic. Thanks for talking to me, and it's nice to be home.
Well, Therese Mudway always has so much interesting stuff to talk about. We never get through it all because she has reams and reams and reams of information. But we thought we'd get her back on the program today talking about something that everybody needs to be aware of. Observe the Observer. What have we got to do there?
Well, have you ever noticed, Ben, how you get very attached to things?
Why do we get attached to things?
Well, we're kind of dancing generally between two spaces. We're either attached to, I want that,
mm-hmm.
So attached to the pleasures in life, if you like, or attached to avoiding the pain. Answer this, Ben. Are you your thoughts and feelings?
Well, I don't think we are, but I think sometimes we fall into the fact that we might be.
Totally. So if you kind of look at it in the sense of, say, your hand.
Yep.
Yeah, you look at your hand. You've got a hand. Your hand is a part of you,
mm-hmm.
but you're not your hand.
No.
You have thoughts and feelings, and your thoughts and feelings are part of you, but you're not your thoughts and feelings.
Okay. So if we're listening in today, what are some tips that you can give us to help us observe the observer?
Meditation is a really good thing, because you start to notice your thoughts and feelings. Now, if you want to learn more about meditation, on my website, which mm-hmm. is www.theresemudway.com, you can actually download on the bottom of the homepage, there's a notice board, and you can download a paper I wrote on transcendental meditation. So meditation is one of the good things that you can start to put into practice. Another thing that you can do is start small. So give yourself a little test or a little trial and say, okay, so what if I didn't drink coffee for a week? That's obviously if you're a coffee drinker or if you're a chocolate eater or something that you know isn't that good for you and you want to let go of or you want to give up. What you can do is say, well, let's use you as an example, Ben. What is it, something that you enjoy that you know isn't so good for you?
Well, funnily, you should say that, coffee.
Coffee, okay. Yep. So let's say you just make a decision. You say, okay, I'm going to give up coffee for a week.
Yep.
When's your favourite time of the day to have a coffee?
Usually, sometimes before I start work.
Okay, before you start work.
Yep.
Okay, so let's say you do that for a week.
Mm-hmm.
You get up and you'll feel like a coffee. And then you'll think about a coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll really feel like a coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have an opinion about whether you can have a coffee or not. And then you'll have an argument in your head about whether you can have a coffee. And then you'll really feel like it, and then you start getting a headache or whatever it is.
Sure.
And the trick here is to observe yourself having those thoughts and feelings without taking action around it.
Ah, very interesting. Well, we can all try that.
Yeah, you could. You absolutely can, and it's a really, really powerful thing, because can you get that when you learn to be unattached to an outcome, whether it's a cup of coffee or a job interview, there's a really powerful space. The moment we get attached to something, whether it's avoiding something or gaining something, that's where all the suffering and drama starts.
Very interesting. So there's your tips today on Observe the Observer. It's very, very interesting stuff, you know. You could talk all day about it.
That's not even scratching the surface.
I know it's not. I know it's not.
There is just, because the other part of it, then people start saying, well, if I start observing, well, then does that mean I don't care, right? So I don't care about this or I don't care about that. The key is to be intentional in achieving your goals without attachment to achieving your goals.
Very good advice there. So what's the website again, Therese, so that we can jump on there and have a look at that paper that you wrote too?
Sure. www.therese,
yep.
T-E-R-E-S-E, Mudgway, M-U-D-G-W-A-Y.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, Michael, in the magazine, you do some really cool things, and one of them's called My Story. So what's that all about?
Well, that's one of the most popular stories in the magazine and also online, and it's basically people's story. They might be doing anything from, you know, getting over alcoholism or addiction. They might have started a charity. But it's those sort of real people out there that you read about and think, gosh, I could do something like that, you know, and it really makes people think. But the guy we've got on the line has done an extraordinary thing. Are you there, Andrea?
Yes, I am. Hello.
How are you? Why don't you tell us your story?
Well, my story just happened a little bit by coincidence. As I was traveling in Pakistan for a private project, a photographic project I was working on in 2008, and I was visiting the northern area of Pakistan, and amongst one of my many tours, I visited a school, and I was quite appalled to see in what conditions the kids are trying to learn the basics.
So you had no prior experience about schools or charity or anything like that?
Absolutely nothing.
So what did you do? Tell us exactly what you did next.
I was just thinking about it, and then all of a sudden I just got up, picked up the phone, called my guide, and I said, look, I want to help the schools. I want to start a charity. I want to raise money through friends and family and people who know me. Can you help me? And especially, how much is it going to? How much are you going to cost me? Because I have to put that in the balance to make it worth it. And we had a chat about it. And in the end, he said, no, Andrea, no more business between us. You're part of the family now. You stay with us, so the expenses are to a minimum, and we can help the schools. And, you know, a lot of people made some donations. We had big donations, small donations, but it just added up. So the first year, we collected $6,000. And in May of 2011, I went back to Pakistan just a couple of days after they got bin Laden, and we just started giving out whatever the schools needed. So my guide did the groundwork. I told him how much money we had, and he went to some local community schools up in his area, in the northern area of Pakistan, and just said, what do you need? And a lot of them said, look, we need benches, we need desks, we need windows to close the windows, glass for the windows, we need cement bags to fix the roof and all that kind of stuff. So we ended up helping three schools. We had two local carpenters make the benches. So we had 80 benches and 80 desks that could sit three kids each. And then when I got there, I personally paid the carpenters because I'm very wary that money can get, quote-unquote, lost when you're going in those areas. So I just told him, I said, look, you give your word, I come to pay. And he's like, yep, absolutely, that's fine with me. And the reception from the school kids, the locals, the principals of the school, and especially the elder people of the village, was extremely overwhelming. And everybody was so grateful and so kind. And it was, I wasn't expecting such a reaction. So that was the first year. And now I'm going back at the beginning of May of this year for 2 weeks, and we're going to help four different schools. Same thing, they all want furniture, they need materials to fix the schools because the structure exists. Many schools are closed because of the lack of money, because they don't have electricity, they don't have light bulbs. Kids sit on bare floor cement, so...
Can you talk us through what a person would live like in Pakistan?
Look, in the areas that I've visited up north, it's just agriculture and farming. So, you know, when it's time to, I don't know, collect the peaches or the apricots from the trees or go work in the field, very often the women are the ones who do all the work. So if they have to choose between sending a girl to school or sending her in the field so the family can survive, unfortunately, very often education takes second place.
Where do they find the teachers from?
The teachers are local. Many teachers, which is a nice thing to see, have been to school, have gone to bigger cities to finish their education, and many of them come back because that's where their family is, and now they're teaching.
It's an extraordinary thing you're doing, and it's a great My Story. On mindfood.com, we're going to run a gallery of some of your images of, you know, your trips and travels to Pakistan. But I just want to congratulate you and your wife. It's, you know, you're an everyday guy doing an extraordinary thing, and I really take my hat off to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And welcome back to Mind Food Radio. Michael, very interesting. We love art museums.
That's right. Some of our best interviews have been with curators. And
in an art gallery.
Yeah. And today we travel to Shepparton, to the Shepparton Art Museum. And they have exclusively from the Museum of Fine Art in Boston. Mm-hmm. They've got a beautiful new exhibition that's coming, The Golden Age of Prints. And I would like to welcome to the show Kirsten Paisley. Hi, Kirsten.
Hello.
Now, you're the director. Tell us about this new exhibition that's coming.
The Golden Age of Colour Prints. It's an exhibition of ukiyo-e, which is multicoloured woodblock prints from Japan, last 20 years of the 1700s, focusing on three of Japan's greatest, most important ukiyo-e artists, Toriki Inaga, Kitagawa Utamaro, and Shariku, along with a selection of artwork by their contemporaries of the day.
Now, that's quite an interesting take, though, because the prints have quite a following. Last year, I was in the I visited Claude Monet's house in France. It was absolutely beautiful. And I didn't realise before I went there, but his house was full of these Japanese prints. And, in fact, that's what inspired, you know, all his water lily range of paintings and things like that. Is it that range of prints?
That's right.
Yeah,
these works had a major impact on European art, and even contemporary artists today have been influenced by them, both the subject but also the incredible craftsmanship of the works. They're just superb in their design, and the way in which the image itself is kind of structured, I guess, is really extraordinary. And Japanese people always celebrate the season, so of course that was, it was well celebrated during the Impressionist period.
What is it about Japanese art that we love?
I think there's a sense of, you know, always the West has had an infatuation with the Orient and anything that's exotic. But, I mean, these works, they were mainstream images, and these are images of beautiful women and famous actors in the theatre, and allegorical kind of humorous tales about various morals or cheeky behaviour, if you like. So they're really popular subject matters that, of the day, you had these incredible artists producing the images that were in mainstream culture, which is, you know, very different to modern Australia.
Some of them are quite comical, aren't they? They sort of make you smile. You sort of look at them and think, well, I wonder what they were thinking when they did that. But it's you know what they were thinking, you know what I mean?
And naughty too. Like, a number of these artists were engaged in producing erotica as well, and it was quite accepted.
Yeah.
And but, you know, with this, with beautiful craftsmanship. So, yeah, really different.
I think today, though, you know, you've got that huge following globally with the Japanese manga comics, you know, and the beautiful line drawing of that. From a contemporary point of view, the artists, are they, do they lean towards that style of artwork, you know, in terms of looking at the, you know, the golden prints of yesterday?
Contemporary artists in Japan? Oh, look, Japan today has a complete love affair with French art, and all things French, food, you know. The
fashion.
Only really European food you can get in Japan is a croissant, really. It's just a complete love affair.
Hey, Kirsten, thank you very much. Now, when does the exhibition start?
We open on the 7th of March, goes through to 2nd of June, so, yeah, plenty of time to come and see the exhibition, and a huge range of public programs, artist talks, ceramic workshops, print workshops, everything you could think of, there's opportunities to participate in at the museum.
Good stuff.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us today. That was Kirsten Paisley there, the Shepparton Art Museum and the Golden Age of Print. And that's another show out of the way from Mind Food Radio. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you to our guests as well. Now, if you missed something on today's program and you want to listen to it again or past shows that we've done, go to mindfood.com and click on the podcast page there for radio, and you'll get all that information. Now, coming up next week on the program, we're going to be chatting with a guy called Uli. And Uli is a cheesemaker down in Tasmania, so he's got a really cool story coming up next week. Emotional intelligence, Sue Langley will be informing us about some things that we need to be aware of there. We'll also chat with Michelle McHugh, our director of food, of course, about desserts today, afternoon tea tomorrow. And Lainey Brasher, she's got an interesting cause that she's fighting for, and we'll talk to her about being meat-free for a week next week on Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking. Until then, take care and have a great week.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.